Mr. Toscano is well known to you Sunstone attendees. He's been quite active in the organization and is the author of numerous articles and abstracts on religious and subjects of law, subjects of religion and law. He will present a paper on his book and the theme that he addresses in his book of secularism in the educational system. And he will be responded by the remarks will be offered by Professor Frederick Mark Geddix of the J. Reuben Clark Law School at BYU. Professor Geddix was recently installed at BYU. He's a new face down there. We're glad to welcome him here to this session. Before teaching at BYU, he most recently came from the University of Denver College of Law. And prior to that, he taught law in Georgia. I'd like to remind everyone that admission to these sessions is by registration only, and that if you have not registered, to please do so in the lobby. There will be a few moments after the remarks, if we remain on schedule, for questions and answers. And at that time, any questions you have, please ask loudly so that we can all hear, and I will proceed to repeat them through the microphone at that time. Without any further delay, I'd like to present to you this time Mr. Paul Toscano. Yes, the book is available through Benchmark Books.
The book looks like this. I hold it up because, so you can see the cover. Most people say you don't judge a book by its cover, but I think we do judge books by their cover. And I think when people see the title of Secularism, Neutrality in the Supreme Court, Invisible Religion in the Schools, they may be tempted to prejudge the book as an effort of another zealot to insinuate, religious zealot, to insinuate religion into the ideologically neutral environment of American public schools. This conclusion, however, would be wrong about my book. The premise of my book is not that religion ought to be taught in our public schools, but that it is in fact already being promulgated there, contrary to the First Amendment's guarantee against the establishment of religion by government. Since the United States Supreme Court has interpreted the religion clauses of the First Amendment as mandating a separation of church and state, a decision which came down in 1947, public schools as state institutions are prohibited from promoting religion of any kind and from contributing in any way to the mission of any traditional religious organization. According to the court, schools are to be religiously neutral, both in their instructional content and government is also to be neutral in its treatment of religion and religious institutions. Well, to be genuinely neutral, as the court requires, a public school must not only avoid theism, but atheism, antitheism, and agnosticism as well, for each of these is religious insofar as it affirms, contradicts, ignores, or denies that God or the supernatural is or can be known. Secularism, too, must be avoided because it is predicated on a number of religious propositions, including the assumption that God and the supernatural are irrelevant to human history and that we humans are the ultimate arbiters of our own destiny. True ideological neutrality in an educational context mandates education devoid of values, assumptions, aspirations, or expectations. In other words, it mandates no education at all. Courts, legislatures, school systems, educators, and groups of parents and concerned citizens have failed to see this point. As a result, they have for a number of decades attempted systematically to eliminate nearly every vestige of traditional religion from the public schools in order to establish them as centers of purely secular instruction. Though this state of affairs does not offend the sensibilities of most Americans who esteem and admire the secular worldview, it puts a heavy and, I believe, unconstitutional burden on those who prefer non-secular, that is, traditional belief structures and approaches. The crux of the problem is that federal and state governments, through mandatory taxation, coerce all citizens to support secular schools, but withhold financial support from non-secular schools. Thus, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, and the adherents of other traditional religions are forced by the state to support secular education, whether or not they send their children to the public schools. But the adherents of secularism may not be coerced to support traditional religious education. This imbalance is justified because secularism is almost universally equated with ideological and religious neutrality. It is not classified as a religion in its own right because it does not sport the traditional indicia of religion and because its fundamental religious nature is seldom recognized. But the religious characteristics of secularism are becoming more obvious, and growing numbers of Americans are beginning to object to the state's hostility toward traditional theistic religion and its preference for secular religion. The primary thesis of my book is not that secularism should be disfavored or eliminated, only that its monopoly in tax-supported public schools constitutes a grievous violation of the equal protection guarantees of the 14th Amendment and of the anti-establishment and free exercise guarantees of the First Amendment of the Constitution. Of course, immediately there's going to be a response to say, well, I just simply don't believe that secularism is a religion. And to see why it is a religion, it's necessary first to define what secularism is and what religion is. To put it succinctly, secularism asserts that all moral and other choices should be made solely upon our own well-being in this present life. I don't mean personal well-being, I mean the well-being of humans. To the exclusion of all considerations drawn from a belief in the supreme being, or an afterlife, or a supernatural order. Secularism is the view that all human problems are soluble by humans through science, technology, individual and institutional power. It is the ideology of logic and objectivity. It is the offspring of reason, the root of science, and the wellspring of modern technology. Because secularism is sometimes referred to as humanism, there has been some needless confusion and argument. The term humanism may be applied to a number of concepts, some of which have little or nothing to do with secularism. These include the study of the Greek and Roman classics and of poetry, art, and literature, the love of reason and wisdom, and the school of literary criticism opposed to the realistic or positivistic school. Secularism is a specific type of humanism. Hans Kung has noted that secularism once referred primarily to the transferences in a legal political sense of ecclesiastical property to worldly uses by individuals and states. But today it has come to mean more. As he observes, quote, it seems that not only certain items of property, but more or less all the important spheres of human life, learning, economy, politics, law, state, culture, education, medicine, social welfare, have been withdrawn from the influence of the churches, of theology and religion, and have come under the direct responsibility and control of man, by which he means mankind, who has himself thus become secular. Jeremy Rifkin explains that the secular worldview took shape some 400 years ago, and while it has been greatly refined and modified in the years since, it has retained much of its early vision. It was originally forged by such intellectuals as Descartes, Newton, and Galileo, and although, as Rifkin says, it could not be explained by one individual out of 100, yet its shadow is always with us, influencing our every move, unquote. Secularism is a religion because it fits the definition of religion in its broadest sense and because it is constituted and functions like a religion. The word religion embraces a wide range of differing types of belief structures, sacral, secular, sectarian. When we think of religion, we usually start by thinking of a belief in God. To state it more generally, to an individual's vertical relationship to a higher order of being, to the transcendent, to all that lies beyond ordinary human experience and sensory reality, to the transrational, the supernatural, the occult, the divine, the infinite, to anything that may serve as an a priori source of human knowledge or a foundation for the explanation of human experience. In this sense, religion embraces what Walter Stace referred to as the hunger of the soul for the impossible, the unattainable, the inconceivable. But many people have given a much broader meaning to the term religion, broad enough to encompass human concerns lying beyond this vertical axis connecting the transcendent with the immanent. For these people, religion embraces concerns that clearly lie within the horizontal plane and that touch matters humanitarian and social. The ultimate practical and philosophical concerns about life, death, good, and evil. When religion is expanded to include our fundamental concerns with our fellow beings and with our natural environment, the line between philosophy and religion becomes blurred. What is religion to one person is philosophy to another. Thus, no definition of religion can be devised that will not, depending upon one's point of view, potentially embrace some or all philosophical concerns. Viewed in this way, religion is an absolute social necessity, for without the ideological and practical tools it provides us for dealing with the ultimate questions of life, society would stagger beneath what Yinger characterized as an enormous burden of tragedy unallayed and hostility unrestrained. A proper definition of religion, then, must include any worldview which serves as a framework to aid comprehension. In Marilyn Ferguson's words, it is a paradigm, a scheme for understanding and explaining certain aspects of reality. As worldview, religion serves as a loom upon which the disconnected strands of experience, tastes, smells, sights, sounds, and textures can be woven into meaningful patterns. Our myths, models, and symbols are like the lenses through which we see the world, and like lenses, they are often invisible to us, though they may make much else crystal clear. They allow us to form opinions about the nature of being, to enlighten us on every facet of life, good and evil, holiness and depravity, success and failure, pleasure and pain, to recognize a good spouse, a good friend, a good education, a good career, and a good life. We must recognize, then, that some of our most cherished religious notions are concocted out of bits and pieces of intellectual riprap that we pick up from random reading, from casual conversations with family, friends, teachers, and from opinion leaders who influence us through the media. Thus, as Jeremy Rifkin observed, most people in this country accept without much questioning the notion that the world is progressing toward a more valuable state, that the individual exists as an autonomous entity, that nature has an order to it, that scientific observation is objective, that competition between individuals has always occurred. Some of these myths are true, others are not, but they all have the power to confer sight upon those who believe in them. It is our religions, our worldviews, that give us our vision, our meaning. This vision is not, however, confined to the present. Religion also makes possible our theories of the past and our expectations of the future. Perhaps the greatest contribution of the human paradigmatic capacity is to raise to a level of awareness the presence of interruptions in the patterns we perceive around us. Life interrupted by death, love by loss or indifference, freedom by constraint, pleasure by pain, expectation by frustration or failure. It is the recognition that no mortal life is immune from such interruptions that sometimes gives rise to a new transcendental vision, to the belief in an existence outside the present world, beyond death perhaps, somewhere unaffected by these slips and breaches in the scheme of things. Thus, our religions suggest the existence of a great beyond, a hopeful future, a better place, an ideal world of perfection, truth, and beauty. This is the source of our imagination, our art, and our humanitarian. This vision is the source of our imagination, our art, and our humanitarian and religious impulses. They suggest that the end of life is not the end, but the beginning of a journey that extends over unnumbered horizons, perhaps forever. In its broadest sense, then, religion consists of any belief structure that provides its adherents with a framework of assumptions, that is, doctrines or dogmas, or of methodologies for contact with reality, that is, ritual, or of rules governing social relationships, that is, ethics, by which a person may create meaning out of the discrete elements of human experience. Or a religion could be something that serves as the basis upon which a person may fabricate theories of the past and expectations of the very near or very distant future. Or that allows a person to create expectations of the transcendent world, whether it be in material or spiritual terms. Or that provides substance from which a person may spin notions of duty for self and others. Religion in this wider sense can range from private and democratic to institutional and authoritarian. It can be mystical or mundane. It can be consistent or inconsistent, simple or complex, pure or eclectic, objective or subjective, rational or intuitive, reasonable or linear or paradoxical, sacral or secular. The assertion that secularism is a religion is not new. However, the religious constitution of secularism is camouflaged so that it may be well to take a closer look at its specific elements. Secularism has its own naturalistic miracles, ethics, rituals, priesthood, doctrines, and dogmas, and it provides its adherents with a paradigmatic structure that gives meaning and purpose to life. The miracles of secularism, for example, consist of all of the scientific and technological advancements, from antibiotics to Xerox machines, that have resulted from the application of logic and science. These miracles constitute the most powerful and convincing evidence that the religion of secularism, or the worldview of secularism, is true, and that the secular view of the universe is reality itself. The ethic of secularism is predominantly hedonism, the belief that the ultimate good is to provide the most pleasure to the most people here and now by maximizing human potential, fulfilling human needs, and providing to as many people as possible the materialistic miracles of modern science while simultaneously minimizing human stress, suffering, pain, and loss with as little damage to the environment as possible. The rituals of secularism include the techniques of scientific experimentation and validation, complete with the requirement for objective, observable, predictable, demonstrable, and verifiable data, as well as the statistical methodologies that make possible the use of probabilities to formulate assessments of the past and the present and to create predictions of the future. The secular priesthood consists primarily of doctors, lawyers, and social scientists, professions that mediate between us and our bodies, our minds, our laws, and our social institutions. Like traditional priests, the professions intercede between humans and the unknown. Secular priests have their liturgies, their craft, and their sacred artifacts. Their altars come in the form of the surgeon's operating table, the psychiatrist's couch, the technician's computer console, and the judge's bench, the lawyer's desk. Their tables assume the forms of their temples assume the forms of laboratories, hospitals, and courts. Their monasteries are libraries, universities, and professional schools. Their vestments are the three-piece suit, the white lab coat, the judicial robe. Their sacred symbols, the balance, the caduceus, the stars and stripes. Secular doctrines can be divided into various philosophical or religious categories, including the secular cosmogony. The universe began with an accident, the Big Bang, out of which unfolded space, time, and all the swirling eddies of matter and energy from which were formed galaxies, stars, solar systems, comets, planets, and satellites. The secular cosmology is that there is in the universe but a single natural plane of existence. No supernatural order exists. Humanity is apparently the only intelligent life in that solitary dimension where chance rules and where the primary pattern is that of emergent evolution. The secular epistemology is that the five human senses are the only reliable means by which knowledge of reality can be conveyed to man's brain. The rational processes are the only trustworthy means by which the sense data can be validated and fitted into a meaning-giving structure. What cannot be gathered through and comprehended by reason is unimportant in the quest for truth. The secular salvific vision is that life's purpose is for each to achieve the best of all possible worlds here and now through the acquisition and use of power, wealth, celebrity, and pleasure, and to extend on an equal basis the full benefits of our achievements to all humans while causing the least amount of damage to the planet. The secular eschatology is that in the end all of the achievements of mankind will disappear into oblivion when all the stars cool and all the lights go out. Therefore, whatever meaning life has must be fashioned by us. The assumptions of secularism, like the dogmas of other religions, are closely related to its doctrines and consist of unprovable and usually unarticulated a priori propositions that are widely accepted without question by their adherents. These assumptions constitute an unofficial creed that includes some of the following axioms. Humanity is the highest and most intelligent manifestation of life. There are no unsolvable problems. If we think well of ourselves, we will triumph. Ignorance and nature are our greatest challenges. And ignorance will be overcome, nature will be tamed. Evil is that which tends to obstruct the goal of bringing the most pleasure to the most people. Crimes are the result of mental aberrations and diseases. The key to personal societal health lies in therapy and rehabilitation. Permanent failures do not exist. Of course, some secularists would not accept all of the tenets I've just listed. Others would insist that other concepts be included. Most would undoubtedly object to the characterization of the list as a creed or to being themselves labeled as religious adherents, but this means only that each secularist defines secularism a little differently. And of course, one can believe in many of the secular doctrines while simultaneously believing in many of the traditional theistic doctrines. This does not mean that secularism is not a religion. It means only that, like Christianity, it is a religion of many forms, manifesting itself in many sects. This variety is itself evidence of the pervasive religious function secularism performs for modern society. This, however, is not to say that secularism should be disparaged, disfavored, or discouraged. There is much that is admirable in the informal secular creed. Secularism has been a source of tremendous illumination and has served as a powerful corrective to the abuses of traditional religion. It has been the champion of individual freedom and of the value and dignity of the human person. It is generally more disposed to religious tolerance than non-secular religions, even if it does not see itself as a religion and is not disposed to be treated as one. It has contradicted concepts like predestination, the divine right of kings, and the abject reliance on the authority of an elite group. It has promoted individual growth and the importance of personal empowerment and validation. Secularism is much less stringent in its requirement for intellectual conformity, although at times it can be hostile or contemptuous of non-objectivity. Moreover, it is not subject to the control of ecclesiastical leaders, although it has its rhapsodists and exponents and zealots. Secularism seeks to impose fewer taboos, a fact which some regard as a negative. Its predispositions and assumptions are, at least in theory, not rigidly fixed, although some secularists can be quite dogmatic about the value and truth of secularism and science. The secular assumptions emphasize mainly processes and principles that deal with accumulating facts, validating truth, resolving disputes, and gathering consensus. In attempting to move the pendulum back away from a secular monopoly toward a more centrist view that seeks to accept and accommodate in the public sphere a wide variety of belief structures, it is important that secularism itself not be denigrated. However, though secularism has made a positive contribution to our culture, it can no longer be allowed to hold a favored place in our public schools. The secular worldview could be quite right about how to make our gizmos and gadgets work and still be quite wrong about the nature of cosmic reality. Our computers and antibiotics would go right on performing their miracles, even if the universe began with a whimper rather than a big bang. The universe we experience can be explained in many different ways. Secularism is better at demonstrating the causes and predicting the effects of physical phenomena. Other worldviews may be better at providing us with meaning. All of them have their strengths. All of them have their limitations. None of them should have a monopoly. But in America today, secularism does have a monopoly, for it remains the ideology of preference in our public schools. Presently, the greatest obstacle to the accommodation of various worldviews in our society in general, and our public schools in particular, is the United States Supreme Court, which has steadfastly refused to open the school doors to alternative religious ideologies on a voluntary basis to those segments of society who desire them, while continuing to accord a secular program to those who do not. The court, by confusing secularism with religious neutrality, continues to subsidize the secular viewpoint at the expense of all competitors. The court's flawed theory of neutrality has changed little since it was first promulgated in its 1947 decision in the case of Everson versus the Board of Education. In the court's view, ideological neutrality means the absence of theistic concepts, but not the absence of secular ones. As a result, its Establishment Clause decisions have been lopsided. For example, in the public schools, the theory of evolution cannot be banned, but countervailing theories about the provenance of life must be banned. A moment of silence may be observed for secular purposes, but not to promote voluntary prayer. A high school meditation club or an evolution club or even a gay or lesbian club may be permitted during school hours on First Amendment grounds because it would be based on belief systems foreign to traditional theology and from which a public school system need not be separated. But a high school Bible club may not be permitted to meet on campus during school hours because its presence is considered an impermissible advancement of non-secular religion from which the public schools must be totally separated. Although recently there have been some inroads into that jurisprudence. The practical effect of the court's approach has been to close the school doors to theism while leaving them open to every secularism imaginable. The court's use of the term neutrality in such decidedly non-neutral situations as these has exasperated many critics and led them to question the validity and fairness of the court's mandate for religious neutrality in the public schools. The court's deep commitment to the mirage of ideological neutrality is reflected in Justice William O. Douglas's dissent in a decision in his dissent in Board of Education versus Allen, where he wrote, "There is nothing ideological about a bus. There is nothing ideological about a school lunch or a public nurse or a scholarship. But the textbook," he says, "goes to the very heart of education in a parochial school." Douglas's certainty here is a manifestation of the self-referencing blindness of the entire court and of many others as well, namely the failure to see in ourselves what we can easily discern in others. The point is that there is something quite ideological about a bus, at least to a member of the Old Order Amish community who shun buses and other modern conveniences on religious grounds. There is something quite ideological about a school lunch to an Orthodox Jew who will not eat non-kosher food, or to those who shun meat or food with preservatives in it, or who will not accept government handouts or subsidies as violative of religious belief or as a matter of conscience. There is as much ideology involved in a nurse trained in secular medicine as there is in a practitioner trained in holistic medicine or faith healing. And as for a scholarship, if offered for high achievement in secular subjects, it is as ideological as a scholarship offered for excellence achieved in religious subjects. Because the Supreme Court is comprised mainly of adherents of the secular view, they cannot readily see, when they are advancing as neutral and non-ideological, values that are, in fact, religious, in the extreme, and entirely susceptible of being established contrary to the guarantees of the First Amendment. This has happened before. Americans saw no abridgment of the religious freedom enforcing Jehovah's Witnesses to salute the flag. In the majority view, such a civil exercise was religiously neutral. This same view is held today when the state forces individuals who dissent on religious grounds to comply with school health checkups and vaccinations, to view videos and movies, or to attend public school up to age 16. What appears to be a merely civil requirement to one person may be a religious exercise or an anti-religious exercise to another. What was to a Roman a pinch of incense offered to a lifeless statue as part of a public ceremony was to an Orthodox Jew or Christian a matter of deepest theological import. It is often forgotten that a religious view of things transforms actions and ideas, seemingly harmless and insignificant to the secular world, into matters of life and death, or more importantly, of eternal life and eternal death. The right to hold, express, preach, and live by one's religious views without interference of even the slightest kind lies at the heart of religious freedom and should not be abridged unless such freedom can clearly and convincingly be shown to interfere with a compelling state interest of the highest order, such as the right of citizens to be protected from criminal behavior involving the use of arbitrary violence or force, or the threat of violence or force, or to be protected from deceit that results in some form of measurable damages, or from illegal trafficking in controlled substances. In Board of Education versus Allen, Justice Douglas warned of the danger of the states deviating from a neutral position by providing to parochial school children textbooks which their churches choose. He cites examples of a science book that mentions God when discussing embryology, of an economics book that comments on socialists' denials of Christ. Douglas wonders whether the history of the Crusade should be taught from a Christian or a Muslim point of view. All these and other examples he raised in support of the idea that because textbooks can present even secular material from a religious vantage point, that such books chosen by churches should not be provided at state expense to children in parochial schools, he says, because it would amount to state aid to religion. But Douglas and the majority of the court failed apparently to see the larger point. All school subjects are presented from a point of view. If it is not from the view of Christianity or Islam or Judaism, then from the point of view of secularism. What the court fails to resolve is how the state's preference for a secular worldview is constitutionally justified. In the public schools, is there any more justification for the use of an embryology textbook that asserts God's hand in human development than the use of one that denies it or that simply ignores the possibility of divine involvement? Because all ideologies are fundamentally religious, ideological neutrality is not possible in an educational setting, at least not in such a setting that attempts to treat any meaningful ideas. This the court has not yet recognized. In its continuing attempt to do what I consider to be the impossible, it promotes a juridical base that favors the majority ideology while discriminating against all others. The court, I believe, must abandon its mandate for ideological neutrality, because it's impossible, and instead mandate for individual believers, secular and non-secular, the equal protection of the law required for people of differing races and alienages. What I'm trying to say there in that complex sentence is that I think that the same way we treat different races and alienages, we should treat different religions, even-handedly. In other words, ideological neutrality should be abandoned in favor of neutrality of treatment. The first step in achieving this goal is to acknowledge that secularism is a religion in the Establishment Clause sense and that it stands on an equal footing with all other ideologies. The second step is to recognize that the government's exclusive support of secular education without providing similar aid for non-secular education to those who demand it constitutes the establishment of religion contrary to the First Amendment. The third step is to recognize that government aid to secular and non-secular religious education, apportioned even-handedly without regard to ideological content, does not constitute the establishment of religion, but the accommodation of religion and the promotion of religious free exercise and ideological pluralism. But if such steps were taken and such a realignment made in the Court's Establishment Clause jurisprudence, what would become of our public schools? Several alternative possibilities present themselves. The first is that state schools would opt to remove from the curriculum all religious ideas, secular and non-secular. This approach, however, would make meaningful education a joke. Physical sciences, social sciences, history, biology, health, physical education, civics. Because none of these can be approached from a truly neutral perspective, they would probably all be unsuitable for presentation in public schools that are truly neutral ideologically. Even such apparently non-neutral subjects as grammar, writing, reading, arithmetic, basic mathematics, diction, personal hygiene, agriculture, mechanical, vocational, and homemaking skills could be objected to on religious grounds as growing out of philosophical predispositions about the nature and destiny of humanity that are essentially religious because they are matters of faith and preference. The attempt to rid the schools of all secular and non-secular ideological influences would lead to the elimination of any subject that remotely touches upon any ideology from atheism to Zen, thus destroying public education as we know it, and for this reason, this alternative cannot be taken seriously. A second alternative is for state schools to require all students to learn about all ideologies in order to avoid a preference for the secular view. This approach, however, is not likely to be acceptable to most Americans either. The image of public schools forced by law to balance secular education with courses from Christianity to Confucianism and from Mormonism to the teachings of the Reverend Moon is not an image that is likely to attract favorable support. Most parents would undoubtedly object to the exposure of their children to ideologies they find alien or repugnant. And school officials would probably oppose the practically impossible task, given the limitations of time and resources, of presenting even the least objectionable non-secular ideologies in public classrooms. For these reasons, the concept of pure accommodation, or perhaps more accurately, forced accommodation, is untenable. There is a third alternative. Public schools, recognizing that if free public education is to be meaningful, it must be premised upon one worldview or another, may continue to educate their students in the secular tradition. But to avoid an unconstitutional establishment of secularism, the schools must provide alternative education on a demand basis to those who dissent from the secular norm on religious grounds. Thus, state funds may be used to pay for traditional religious education, just as it has been used to pay for secular religious education in the past. Such a fundamental change in church-state relations in the schools will not spell the end of secular education in America, nor will it turn the public schools into centers for the proselyting of young converts or into enclaves of traditional religious indoctrination and ritual. Each school child will continue to be protected from the imposition of any religious ideas contrary to the will of the child or her parents. Secular schools will continue to exist because they promote the worldview that is the least offensive to the vast majority of Americans. However, because the religious nature of secularism is recognized and acknowledged, government must accommodate all those wishing to pursue alternative religious education, a program that should be no more problematical and no less important than racially integrating the schools or mainstreaming handicapped children. In a free society, public schools should not be allowed to discriminate against a minority on the basis of religious preference any more than on the basis of race, sex, alienage, or income. Public educators need not abandon the work of decades, nor need the transition from secular schools to open and pluralistic ones be traumatic. The process of religious accommodation should be made in the least expensive and least disruptive way to accomplish this. Two different tactics are available. The first is to provide state funds in the form of vouchers, tax credits, or reimbursements for educational fees and costs to those who desire non-secular education for themselves and their children. The other way is to withhold direct outlays of state funds from private and parochial schools, but to provide non-secular alternative educational opportunities in secular schools to parents or students who object to secular education. These opportunities should be provided in a way that meets the objections of the religious minority, again, in the least costly and disruptive way, which could involve alternative course segments, alternative courses, alternative teachers, and even alternative schools. Because the offensive posture of the majority in advancing a secular ideology forced the defensive posture of the religious minority, it is only fair to expect the offending party to help shoulder the minority's burden, particularly if the minority is required to contribute toward the offending majority's ideology by way of compulsory taxation. It is foreseeable that in those areas of the country where secularism does not predominate, it will be the secularists who will be in the minority and who will avail themselves of these alternatives to ensure that their children are not exposed to undesirable non-secular ideologies. This would mean, of course, that children would be exposed in school through other children to differing religious views, as happens in American society all the time. However, the First Amendment's religion clauses do not protect against mere exposure to ideas or beliefs that are offensive to or supportive of any religion. Notwithstanding this normal exposure, no children would ever be forced, under my theory, to be educated in ways that violate his or her parents' free exercise rights. Moreover, the public schools may promote certain values that are fundamental to our constitutional system, so long as they are not imposed upon a child over his or her parents' religious objections. And no children or parents would be allowed to compel the withdrawal of curriculum or to impose a curriculum on others. For under this view, dissenters, secular and non-secular, would not be allowed to sanitize the schools of religious content that is objectionable to them. All religions must be accommodated on a demand basis unless it can be shown that the religious expression in question is criminal, obscene, or virulently antisocial. And that would have to be determined by the court, what I mean by that, but I mean essentially obscene. Short of such a showing, no one should be allowed to sanitize the schools from the free exercise and open accommodation of religion any more than they should be allowed to sanitize society at large from these activities. The only remedy for dissenters would be to withdraw from the offending expression in the least disruptive and most cost-effective way to the school system. The abandonment of a single secular ideology in the public schools cannot be accomplished without considerable cost and without the expenditure of vast amounts of time and psychic energy, all dedicated to the integration into American culture of a truly religiously free and open educational system. Though indubitably difficult, it is a work I don't believe that we can any longer postpone. There is obvious interest in this country in religions of all kinds. As some belief structures lose their hold upon the imaginations of Americans, and as individuals seek to reinterpret their experience in mythic as well as rational terms, they must be left open to pursue these explorations. If the nation's children are to be prepared for their roles as adults and citizens, the public schools must equip them with an awareness of and tolerance for such belief structures. If future generations are to cope with ideological plurality without bigotry, then exposure in the public schools to a diversity of worldviews should be an indispensable component of education. Our public schools should be microcosms of pluralism, where children can learn to balance personal freedom and community responsibility. The Constitution should not be interpreted to shield all Americans from the Constitution must be interpreted to shield all Americans from imposed ideological conformity that has become the hallmark of totalitarian governments of both the extreme left and the extreme right, and to reaffirm the inalienable right of each individual to adopt the conceptual paradigms of his or her choice. These are our most fundamental freedoms. They are the soul of all of the liberties guaranteed to us in this nation's founding documents.
Well, I will say at the outset that I enjoyed reading Paul Toscano's book. It's written with passion and with conviction. His argument progresses carefully and logically to his conclusion. It's well-researched, and it's still accessible. I recommend it to anyone who is interested in the conflict between the Supreme Court and religion and public education, and especially to non-lawyers who are looking for an introduction to issues in this area. But having said this, I will also say that in my view, I think the argument is flawed. I disagree with Paul's definition of religion, which is crucial to the argument that he makes. Now, this perhaps is kind of a cheap shot. Everyone always argues about definitions, and maybe it's the easiest way to attack an argument. But this definition, I think, is a symptom of a broader error that ultimately subverts the attractive and compelling vision of pluralistic education, which he sketches at the end of the book. Now, Paul defines religion as, and I'm paraphrasing here, any comprehensive worldview that explains the meaning of human history and existence and generates ethical duties. And then he adds another component. He says that the worldview must also, and here I'm quoting, allow a person to create expectations of the transcendent world. This, I think, is a hedge, and I think we know it's a hedge because instead of saying that religion requires belief in the transcendent, he says it permits expectations of the transcendent. That means that secularism can be a religion because a secular person, because secularism permits one to create an expectation of the transcendent world, which is that there's nothing there. If transcendent beliefs, on the other hand, were a necessary component, then secularism couldn't be a religion, and the argument simply wouldn't work. Paul's use of the Supreme Court's own precedents to show that public education teaches secularism in violation of the Establishment Clause depends on secularism's being classified as a religion. Now, I don't think this definition is very faithful to the history of Western religion. Joan of Arc didn't just come up with innovative battle plans. She heard the saints talking to her. And John Wesley didn't simply come up with a more meaningful way of talking about Jesus. He was born again. The explosion of Protestant fundamentalism that occurred in the Second Great Awakening was not about cosmic meaning or ethical duties. The people of the burned-over district were actually spiritually revived. Joseph Smith didn't emerge from the Sacred Grove contemplating the greater meaning of life and the greater ethical duties that he may have to his fellow human beings that were implied by his new knowledge of God. And I think that that was not the most important thing in the minds of the early members of the church, although certainly it was an aspect. People converted to Mormonism because Joseph claimed to have talked with God and to have received golden plates from an angel. That's about as transcendent, I think, as it gets. And they believed him in the main because they experienced their own spiritual witnesses. The encounter with the transcendent is a common and a crucial part of the Western religious experience, and Paul has left that out of his definition. I think his definition mistakenly mushes religion and ideology together. Virtually all religions are ideologies, but the converse is not true. The breadth of religion is not coextensive with that of ideology. Under Paul's definition, religion could be literally anything, which towards the end of his book he admits. I'm paraphrasing again here, but it includes science, social science, art, economics, weight loss schemes, money-making schemes, friendship, domination, efficiency, and last, of course, the real religion of America, sex. This, I submit, is not a very useful concept. Because religion can mean anything, it really means nothing. Now, this sort of, and everything can mean religion to somebody, approach to constitutional law, I think, is typical of liberal political theory as it has evolved during the last three centuries or so. And I add parenthetically that in using the word liberal, I'm not talking about left-wing politicians, but rather about the political tradition begun by Hobbes and Locke and others in the wake of the upheavals caused by the Reformation in Europe. The religious wars that were spawned by the Reformation suggested that social choices between strongly held ideologies were disruptive. The strategy of liberalism, then, is for society to make as few of these choices as possible. Let people believe and act as they want as long as they don't kill each other. And we'll create this huge, powerful government to make sure that they don't kill each other. Now, after the 30 Years' War, not imposing value choices and letting people believe and act as they please can sound pretty good. And it sounds pretty good today. As I said, I found Paul's vision of radically pluralistic education very attractive. But consider this. What if the American Nazi Party sets up a school and teaches that the Holocaust never happened and the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait was orchestrated by Jewish bankers? Or the Ku Klux Klan starts a school and teaches that African Americans are subhumans who may be hunted like animals? Or the Institute of Pornographers teaches that women exist to fulfill male sexual fantasies? You get the idea. I don't like these religions, and I don't think you like them either. They're bad. They condition people to think in a way that is oppressive to Jews and to blacks and to women. The oppression that occurs, and the oppression occurs even if they don't actually commit the physical harms that society defines as crimes. They are psychological assaults whose effects are real. I don't think government should encourage them, and it certainly shouldn't protect them. But they are religions under Paul's test. And even if not religions, they are ideologies. And liberalism flees from making ideological judgments, just as Paul seems to. Let me give an example. Last month we were all treated to this media spectacle of members of Congress coming on the radio and figuratively rending their custom-tailored suits over the impossibility of banning flag desecration. Outlaw flag burning, they cried, and soon the government will censor the news. The premise of this argument, if one can call it that, is that flag desecration and news censorship are indistinguishable. There is apparently no way that a line can be drawn between them. I have a close relative who was in one of the first waves that landed on Normandy Beach in 1944. He was an 18-year-old Mormon farm boy who had never been out of the Mountain West. In his war, he saw more human violence and depravity than he knew could exist, and certainly more than he had ever imagined. He lost his youth and his peace and his innocence. To this day, he will not talk about it. Now, I don't think it's outrageous to suggest that the sacrifice he made deserves some respect. And certainly, I think one can argue that it deserves protection from the mockery that flag desecration makes of what he suffered in the war. Now, my personal view is that the flag desecration statutes were bad laws. But it's not because it's impossible to know the difference between protecting my relative and censoring the news. It's because I think the line should be drawn somewhere else, and I'm willing to defend my decision to draw it there rather than here. Where do you draw the line is a feeble excuse for allowing anything and everything. Life is about drawing lines, and we ought to have the guts to try to draw them right. Paul doesn't want to choose. He doesn't want to distinguish good religions from bad religions, or good ideologies from bad ideologies. But not choosing is still a choice. Not to choose means that we tolerate not only all of the good, but also all of the evil that enters into the mind of humanity. For my part, this world of no choice is not a place where I really want to live. In the end, though, I still think that I probably agree with Paul more than I disagree with him. Since the ACLU filed its Establishment Clause challenge to graduation prayers, I've been asked the same question over and over again, and I suspect most lawyers or people familiar with this area have been asked this question too. How come it's unconstitutional to ban flag burning, but it's not unconstitutional to ban prayers? Now, that's not an easy question to answer, even if you think that that's how the world ought to be. Spiritual knowledge in our society is not accepted as real knowledge. It doesn't possess the power and the status of secular knowledge. So when religious arguments and actions show up in any public context, they're highly vulnerable. They're vulnerable in a way that secular arguments and actions are not. To generalize what I think the thrust of Paul's argument is, when the Catholic bishops expound the biblical foundation of economic injustice and arms control, there's a variety of ways you can react to that. You can say they're right or they're wrong, but there was a large group of people who said, these are just a bunch of priests, they ought to stick to religion. So they're criticized for venturing beyond the area of their expertise. When Pat Robertson declares the power of prayer, that's made a great national joke. When Martin Luther King elaborates the theological basis of nonviolence and racial equality, all the television cameras turn off and he is ignored. Liberalism classifies religion as a value, not as a fact, and so liberal politics cannot distinguish among values. But Jesus had powerful and useful insights into economic justice and warfare. Pat Robertson is not the last person left in America who has experienced the power of prayer. And the New Testament imperatives of loving both one's neighbors and her enemies are perfectly captured in nonviolent protest and racial equality. Why shouldn't we be able to talk about these issues in religious terms as well as in secular ones, even in public? I hope we have progressed somewhat from the 16th century so that this is not likely to start another religious civil war. My guess is that the unfairness of privileging secularism and disabling religion in the discourse of public life, which would include public education, was one of the principal motivations was one of Paul's principal motivations for writing his book. And so even though I disagree with his tactics, I can still strongly applaud his effort to dethrone secularism as the privileged discourse in American public life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul and Fred, for your comments. We have a few minutes remaining, so if any of you have any questions, feel free to holler them out here. Yes, sir.
I'll bounce that off to Paul and see what he has to say.
Well, it has to do with whether or not these things won't clarify themselves over time, and I think they will if there's some effort made on the part of individuals in the country. To the question of, I'm kind of still a little bit stunned by Fred's response on one point, and that is about choice. My purpose in writing the book was to promote choice. If the government is supporting a secular educational system, then people are not exposed to other worldviews and cannot make a choice. Because all of their approaches to things are going to be secular, because they're trained right through school to essentially not see things from a religious point of view. And the school system does more than this. It suggests, it implies to children in very subtle ways that religion really is not important. If it were, it would be taught in the schools. It's just not important. So you pursue everything from kind of a secular perspective. And I think that comes from not the existence of secularism in the schools, but from its monopoly there. What I'm against is an ideological monopoly. And I think that monopoly has got to stop. Now, the reason why I define religion broadly, it's not that I'm really comfortable with that definition. I'm not comfortable with the idea of the Nazi parties, the Aryan nation coming down here and setting up a religion, we have to put up with it. I don't like that. But the alternative is to define the kinds of religions we want to protect differently from the kinds from the establishment of religion. That is to say, right now the only religions that can't be in the public schools are traditional theistic religions. Those cannot be established under the Bill of Rights. But the religions that are protected under the Bill of Rights are any religions, including my expanded version of religion. In the conscientious objector cases, when conscientious objectors would not go to war, the first thing the court asked, well, does this guy come from a traditional theistic religion? Well, they couldn't ask that question, because then they said we would then be distinguishing between traditional theistic religions and non-theistic or secular religions, and that wouldn't be fair. We have to protect all religion, even religion that doesn't look like religion. And so when it comes to free exercise, the question I have for Fred is, if secularism should be immune from establishment, should it also be immune from the protections of free exercise? If secularism is something that we can't establish in the schools because the prohibition against establishment should not apply to secularism, should secularism then be taken out of the list of religions we protect, whose free exercise we guarantee? No one wants that. So the reason I have to broaden the definition of religion is to make one consistent definition that will both work within the context of a religion, of the Establishment Clause, and the Free Exercise Clause. We all want all belief structures to be protected. But if we want all of belief structures to be protected in America, then we cannot establish any of them, even the secular one, which we all like because we're used to it. And to the question about, there was another point that he raised in his thing that kind of surprised me, and that was this idea of choice. I'll get back to it. Because if you have children marching lockstep through all these subjects, but you see every subject from the point of view of a secularist, and that you never expose the secular worldview to the criticism of non-secularists, then those children are essentially foreclosed
from that examination of non-secular or theistic religions. And I think that's very dangerous to tamper with the wellsprings of human imagination and knowledge. Because what you're basically doing is you're having a prior restraint on a certain kind of knowledge. You're saying theistic religions are so dangerous or whatever the reason is that we can't even discuss them in our public schools, so therefore we'll just teach these children these other things. And is this preparing them for life in a pluralistic society? It just seems to me to be very misdirected. We're going to have to accept the fact that there's going to be fear, there's going to be trembling, but freedom has a price to pay, and I think Fred has listed what that price is. That isn't the point. My point isn't whether we teach about religions. The point is that those individuals who, for religious reasons, do not want their children in the schools or to take a certain sex education class or to learn a certain particular, like the history of Black America. Technically, you cannot teach that the impetus for the equalization of blacks and whites in America grew out of a religious impulse in the 19th century. Technically, you shouldn't be able to teach what the doctrines were of the churches that gave rise, eventually, to the abolitionist movement that led to the freedom of the slaves.
Or the reasons the pilgrims came to
this country. So if parents say, well, okay, I don't want them just to learn about this. I want them to learn it from a person who believes it. And my question is, why should tax dollars then be withdrawn from those people because they want a certain content of their education? That to me is a kind of indoctrination. Yes.
Specific religions, you open the door for indoctrination.
Yes, to those who want it.
Pardon?
To those who want it.
But if we are also trying to protect all people and make schools, quote, a safe place.
But it's not a safe place. A safe place in America is not a safe place. So what you do there, in order to do that, Delmont, you've got to force the minority to support the majority without a concomitant support by the majority of the minority on a question that should be left to individual choice and not the state. See, that's the conundrum, I see. Well, what about the minority? But the Bill of Rights does not allow us to withdraw. Yeah, I'm just... Well, my problem there is that you are still taking tax money from people who don't want to support the secular school system and putting a double burden of taxation on them if they want to go to Betsy. It's safer for you, but not for the other. I guess we don't have any more time right this
moment. I'm sorry to be the enforcer. We need enough time to set up for the plenary session, which will be taking up the space for all the ballrooms. Once again, I thank Mr. Paul Toscano for his paper, his presentation, and for the remarks of Professor Fred Geddick.